This is Naima Novetsky from AllahTorah.org. Today, we'll explore the first commandment given to and performed by the nation of Israel as a whole, the taking and slaughtering of the Pesach. Shmot chapter 12 discusses how the nation is commanded to take a lamb, smear its blood on their doorposts, and eat it roasted with matzot and bitter herbs. What, though, is the purpose of this whole ceremony? At first glance, the answer seems obvious. Hashem directed the Israelites to apply the blood of the Pesach to their doorposts so that they would be spared during the plague of the firstborn. As Hashem says, "V'haya hadam lachem la'ot al habatim asher tem sham, v'ra'iti et hadam ufasachti alechem, v'lo yevachem negef l'mashrit." And the blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will come upon you to destroy you. From a theological perspective, this explanation is troubling. Why was such a sign necessary to save the nation? Could not Hashem have simply passed over the Israelite homes even without the smearing of blood? After all, he had distinguished between Egyptian and Israelites in previous plagues without any identifying sign. So why should the plague of the firstborn be any different? Finally, who or what is the Mashrit, the destroyer from which the nation needed protection? And how does it relate to Hashem? Though the blood smearing is the most highlighted feature of the Paschal ceremony, the ritual contains many other aspects with detailed laws governing each stage. As such, to truly understand the purpose of the Pesach, we need to delve into these accompanying actions and their objectives as well. Hashem commands that the people take a male, unblemished, year-old lamb to be slaughtered. Is there any significance to this choice? Moreover, why were they supposed to take it a full 4 days before it was to be slaughtered? Second, the Pesach had to be eaten whole, roasted, and accompanied by matzah and bitter herbs. Why? Last, was there any significance to eating the meat while belted, with shoes on, and staff in hand? Or was this simply meant to ensure that all would be ready to depart Egypt at the first opportunity? One last set of questions emerges from a comparison of the first Pesach in Egypt, Pesach Mitzrayim, with the annual Pesach sacrifice, which serves to commemorate it throughout the generations, Pesach Dorot. While the annual Pesach is clearly a sacrifice, was this true of the original Pesach as well? Though the ceremony in Egypt contained the sacrificial features of an unblemished animal and sprinkling of blood, the central elements of an altar and priest were conspicuously absent. Other laws of the Pesach, most notably the blood smearing, are not part of the annual rite. If this was the main focus of the original ceremony, how can we explain its absence in the annual commemoration? Let's attempt to address these questions as we look at three very different approaches to the Pesach presented by commentators throughout the ages. A first approach adopts a literal reading of the verses and explains that the rite really was apotropaic in nature, meant to ward off evil and protect the Israelites from harm during the final plague. Rav Yosef Bachorshor, a 12th century French Tosafist, understands the Mashrit to be a destroying angel, a divine messenger sent to kill the Egyptians and spare the Israelites. According to him, once given permission to destroy, Hashem's messengers do not normally differentiate between good and evil, but are more sweeping in their actions, collectively destroying all. Thus, unlike Hashem, without the sign of the blood of the Paschal sacrifice, the Mashrit, the destroyer, would not have distinguished between Egyptian and Israelite. One might question this approach from the many verses which make it sound as if it was Hashem himself and not a messenger who both smote the Egyptians and saved the Israelites. Hashem uses the first person throughout, Va'avarti, and I passed, V'keiti kol b'chor, and I smote, V'ra'iti et hadam ufasachti aleichem, and I saw the blood, and I had mercy, suggesting that it was Hashem himself who performed these actions and for whom the blood on the doorpost was meant. This position could respond that often a messenger is considered like the one who sent him. So although all these actions are attributed to Hashem, they really refer to the destroyer, to the Mashrit, who is functioning as Hashem's emissary. Sforno, a 16th century Italian commentator, offers an alternative solution, positing a different relationship between Hashem and the Mashrit. He suggests that it was really Hashem himself who smote the Egyptian firstborns while passing over the Israelites, but that simultaneously a more general plague, Negev l'Mashrit, was brought upon the rest of the Egyptian nation. This more general plague, like most plagues, would have been indiscriminate if not for the sign of the blood. Sforno's understanding, besides accounting for the first-person language, has the added advantage of explaining why every home, and not just those of the firstborns, needed the sign of blood. One might still wonder why blood specifically was chosen as a demarcating sign. Sforno and Rav Yosef Bachor Shor do not address the question, only noting parallel cases where innocents are marked so as not to be destroyed. Rav Avraham Ibn Daoud, a 12th century Spanish philosopher, suggests the choice of blood was not incidental, but crucial, for it did not serve simply as a marker, but actually had some inherent powers to ward off the harm of the Mashrit. He compares our story to the story of Moshe in the lodging place in Shmot chapter 4, where a similarly bloody rite, circumcision, is used to ward off evil and potential death. The 14th century Provençal rationalist Ibn Caspi finds it difficult to believe that blood really has innate powers to protect from harm, but he suggests that even though the blood had no such quality, since the people erroneously believed that it did, smearing the blood on their doorposts nonetheless served to calm them, ensuring that they did not panic during the plague. As support, Ibn Caspi points to the phrase "V'haya hadam lachem la'ot," the blood will be a sign for you, which suggests that the blood was needed not only for Hashem or for the Mashrit, but for the Israelites themselves. According to Ibn Caspi, Hashem will sometimes take into consideration people's superstitions, even though they are unfounded. As another example, he points to Hashem preventing Bil'am from cursing the Israelites. In that case, even though the curse itself would have been ineffective, Hashem did not want it to instill terror in the hearts of the nation. These sources view the smearing of the blood as the focal point and entire reason for the slaughtering of the Pesach. But they do not explain why in an entire ceremony, with so many accompanying laws directing its taking, its slaughter, and its eating, was necessary. If the whole point was simply to make a bloody sign, why did it matter when the lamb was taken, how it was cooked, and what was eaten with it? These questions are perhaps what lead other commentators to look at the entire ceremony from a different perspective. According to Rav David Zvi Hoffman, a 19th and 20th century German commentator, the Pesach was a Korban Todah, a Thanksgiving offering, meant to express gratitude to Hashem for the nation's impending salvation. As such, it was the slaughtering and accompanying festive sacrificial meal, rather than the blood smearing, which was the central component of the ceremony. Rav David Zvi Hoffman proves that the Pesach was indeed a type of Korban Shlamim, a peace offering, from the fact that both share the unique properties of being called a Zevach, and being eaten by the person bringing the sacrifice. The two sacrificial components that are missing, the altar and the priest, were replaced here out of necessity by the house and the Israelites themselves. For this first sacrifice, the priests had not yet been chosen, and all Israelites served equally as a Mamlechet Kohanim, a kingdom of priests. According to Rav David Zvi Hoffman then, the smearing of the blood was not needed by Hashem, who could on his own distinguish between Egyptian and Israelite, but was simply part of the sacrificial service, the equivalent of the sprinkling of blood that occurs during the offering of many sacrifices. As the Israelites' houses substituted for the altar, the blood was sprinkled on their doorposts. Other aspects of the ceremony can be similarly understood once the Pesach is viewed as a sacrifice. The need to consume the animal by morning and to burn the leftovers parallels the later laws of a Korban Todah. Similarly, the choice of animal and its age are elements shared by many sacrifices. The command to eat the Pesach roasted with matzah and bitter herbs, and while dressed for the journey, all relate to the haste in which the ceremony took place, and may have been intended to ensure the completion of the meal before the plague of the firstborns, thus connecting the Thanksgiving offering with the actual Exodus. As such, this approach manages to obviate the theological difficulty of Hashem needing a sign. It aptly connects Pesach Mitzrayim with the later annual Pesach offering, and it accounts for the necessity for an entire ceremony, including both the sacrifice and the meal. Yet, it has one significant flaw. It does not adequately account for Tanakh's own explanation of the need for the smearing of blood. The chapter explicitly states that the blood served as a sign and that it was the reason for Hashem's passing over of the Israelites. Yet this approach appears to ignore this fact, never explaining why the sprinkling of the blood of a thanksgiving offering would be required for Hashem to save the nation. This leads to a third approach, one which attempts to address the weaknesses of each of the first two positions, to account for the need for the larger ceremony while still addressing how the blood served as a sign, allowing Hashem to save the nation. This approach suggests that the Pesach ceremony was a demonstrative act against idolatry. Since sheep were part of the Egyptian pantheon, the slaughtering of the Paschal lamb served to proclaim Hashem's sovereignty over the Egyptian deities. Exegetes dispute whether this demonstration was aimed mainly at the watching Egyptians or if it was intended for the Israelites themselves. According to both, though, it is the slaughtering of the sheep rather than the meal or the smearing of the blood which was the key component of the rite. Rabag, a 13th century Provençal commentator, views the ritual as an educative process through which the Israelites learned to reject the Egyptian idolatry that surrounded them. In observing the Egyptian god killed and unable either to defend itself or to wreak punishment, the Israelites learned about its impotence. The other details of the ceremony were similarly educative in nature. The sheep chosen was specifically an unblemished male because it was viewed by the Egyptians as the most respected member of its species. In killing it, and nonetheless emerging unscathed, the nation would understand its worthlessness. The sheep was taken a full 4 days prior to its slaughtering to give the nation ample time to reflect on their new beliefs. Rabag further proposes that since the Egyptians would normally punish by fire anyone who defied their gods, roasting the sheep whole was a further sign of disrespect and proof of the inability of the god to punish. Finally, the Rambam notes that idolaters would normally accompany their sacrifices with leavened bread and sweet substances. If so, the choice of matzah and bitter herbs might also be a reaction to and distancing from idolatrous practices. According to Rabag, the smearing of the blood was the culmination of this educative process. It was meant not for Hashem or the destroyer, but for the Israelites themselves, serving as a sign and proof for them, v'haya hadam lachem la'ot, that they had abandoned their beliefs in the Egyptian gods. It was this rejection of idolatry that led Hashem, when seeing the blood, to have mercy on them and not kill them during the plague. Thus, the blood was not needed by Hashem to distinguish between Israelite and Egyptian, but was needed by the Israelites as a way of distinguishing themselves and their beliefs from those of the Egyptians. A variation of this approach reads the ceremony and law similarly, but suggests that the intended audience of the lesson was the Egyptians themselves. The public slaughter of the sheep and smearing of its blood proved to them that their gods were powerless. Many other aspects of the rite similarly served to both degrade the Egyptian idols and to publicize that degradation. Thus, the slaughter took place at twilight to maximize exposure to passersby. The cooking of a sheep on an open fire ensured that the sheep was both seen and smelled by all, while the fact that it was whole ensured that no one could mistake that what was killed was in fact the Egyptian god. Finally, choosing a condiment that was bitter rather than sweet and eating in a hurry were both signs of disrespect. This variation, thus, is quite similar on the whole to that presented by Rabag, but it has one disadvantage. As it views the blood as being a sign for the Egyptians, it obviates the theological difficulty regarding Hashem's need of it, but it has difficulty explaining the verses which clearly state that Hashem will see the blood and act upon it. As such, of the two variations, the position that the rite was aimed at the Israelites might be the more textually solid. To summarize, we have discussed three approaches to the Pesach: those that view it as a protective rite, required for this physical salvation of the nation, those who consider it a thanksgiving offering for the impending salvation, and those who see it as a means to wean the nation away from idolatry. As these three are not mutually exclusive, it's also possible that different aspects of the ceremony had different objectives, and that all three goals were realized through the ceremony. The various approaches we looked at raised several important questions along the way. First, is it possible that Hashem or his messengers are limited in any way? Second, what was the nation's religious outlook when in Egypt? Had they retained their faith or had they assimilated? And finally, need all of Hashem's commands be aimed at spiritual growth, or might some be directed at our physical welfare? For more on this topic and for many other topics on Parashat Bo, please visit alatorah.org.